This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Any stress test that reveals, shall we say, issues requires a follow-up exam. Today was the deadline for regulators to get out the stethoscope and determine whether unhealthy banks should head for the recovery room or back to the operating table. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by ConAgra Foods, the people behind brands like Marie Callender's, Hunt's, and Ready Whip. More at conagrafoods.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 8th day of June. We'll get to the banks in a moment, but first, some news out of the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg issued a ruling that will delay the sale of Chrysler to Italy's Fiat. Chrysler had warned that any hiccups could scuttle the deal. There's no word on how long the temporary hold might be in effect. Meanwhile, you may remember that 9 of the 19 banks put through the government's stress tests didn't quite pass them and were told to raise more cash. Today was the deadline for federal regulators to approve the bank's capital raising plans. And later this week, they'll tell which banks are healthy enough to exit the Troubled Asset Relief Program. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us, top brass at the banks are also getting a second look from the feds.
Already, the feds have forced some shakeups. Last week, after a bit of prodding, Bank of America added 4 new members to its board, including 2 former banking regulators. But Paul Hodges isn't satisfied. He tracks big companies' boards of directors at the corporate library.
We have some issues with the Bank of America board because it's made up of a number of what we call flagged directors, directors who have had problems at companies where they were on the board or are still on the board.
And Hodges says even after recent changes at Citigroup, he still worries the board may be a bit too sympathetic to executives there. Citi's been tweaking its board and management for months, but
there are a great many former and current CEOs on Citigroup's board. It's almost entirely a CEO board.
Michael Patriarca is a former bank regulator who's now at Promontory Financial Group. He says board members need to know the industry, but even more important, they need to be willing to be aggressive, even rude.
Our mothers taught us not to do things like that, but it's really essential for directors.
If board members let their manners inhibit their oversight, Patriarca says it's a recipe for disaster.
You have to have the willingness to ask hard questions that could potentially embarrass people in front of the entire board of directors.
And while it's easy for regulators to judge experience, it's harder to know just who will be willing to anger executives by acting like a bulldog in the corporate boardroom. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Today, the Chinese government announced that personal computers sold in China have to have blocking software. That goes for all manufacturers, including the likes of Hewlett-Packard and Dell. The order is already drawing fire from censorship watchdogs, but don't expect computer makers to say no to Beijing. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from San Francisco.
The company that makes the software China is requiring says, relax. It's just there to block pornographic sites from children, and it can even be turned off by parents. But Stephen Xu, a software developer with experience in cybersecurity, says it could act as a Trojan horse for the Chinese government.
It can probably install other components without the user's knowledge. It can monitor what the user's doing.
Still, he says, manufacturers could be forgiven for complying with Beijing's order because there's not much difference between the Chinese program and, say, antivirus software on most U.S. computers.
This requirement is a requirement that manufacturers and vendors ship the software with their machines. If you see a law later that requires all individuals to actually run the software on their machine, that would be much more invasive and much more consequential.
When asked for comment today, PC makers either didn't respond or said they were waiting for more information.
They're not going to say, we're standing on principle and we believe in free speech, but they might say, we will find it very difficult to comply with your directive.
Roger Kay is an industry analyst with Endpoint Technologies. He says the bottom line is, well, the bottom line. You can't do business these days without doing business in China.
It's one of the largest PC markets in the world, and it's certainly the fastest growing.
Kay says until consumers outside China start rewarding companies that don't play ball with Beijing, there will be little incentive to resist. In San Francisco, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Maybe the next computer-related Chinese government order could address concert tickets that seem to disappear before they even go on sale. You're looking forward to singing along with Miley Cyrus, but the only tickets available are triple the face value. Well, today, Miley and Ticketmaster launched an experiment aimed at helping fans make the climb out of the ticket morass. Jill Barchet reports.
Miley Cyrus hopes she can cut out scalpers from her next tour by selling only paperless tickets. Ones you can't give or sell to someone else. Ones you buy online and pick up at the concert gate by showing your driver's license and a credit card. Sean Pate is the spokesman for StubHub, the big ticket resale site owned by eBay. He's predicting paperless tickets will mean long lines on concert night.
You know, we're going to see a lot of inconveniences for the fans, especially of Miley Cyrus's demographic. Her fans more than likely don't own credit cards.
That means mom or dad may have to listen to the concert, too. Not to mention how mortifying it is for a 12-year-old to be seen with her parents. Critics say some concerts will still sell out quickly, and prices will be jacked up. The question is, by whom? Don Vaccaro is the CEO of Ticket Network, another resale site. He points out that Miley Cyrus's management company, which is owned by Ticketmaster, is selling prime seats on its website starting tomorrow for $295.
Miley Cyrus is, in effect, scalping her own tickets through iloveallaccess.com and pocketing those proceeds.
Resellers fear paperless tickets are really a way for Ticketmaster to control the entire live music market. Last year, Ticketmaster bought Tickets Now, a leading ticket resale website. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, it was all about burgers and cereal today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Journalists at the Boston Globe find themselves at the center of their own story today. Members of the Newspaper Guild are voting on a contract offer that includes an 8% pay cut and makes significant edits to health and retirement benefits. The Globe's parent company, the New York Times, says it needs $20 million in cuts to keep the paper in print, and it's threatened to slash salaries by almost 25% if the contract is not approved. We wanted to hear from someone who did vote no today, so we're joined by 17-year veteran reporter Scott Allen. Scott, why turn this down?
Needless to say, it was probably the hardest vote I've ever cast. But the New York Times has asked from us more than I think most people can reasonably shoulder after a four-year pay freeze already. And we all understand really well that they need concessions, that they're in bad shape, they need money. We want to help them. But they didn't do anything in putting this package together aimed at softening the blow for the employees. They didn't want more work from us. They didn't want less holidays. They didn't want fewer vacations. Anything we could have offered besides just our money, they were uninterested. And I feel like they were insensitive to a lot of people who've already sacrificed quite a bit for them.
But I wonder if you could let us into your head for a minute, because when you're making this decision, you know full well that there is an axe hanging over your head as you vote, which is that the Times Company has said that it'll force a 23% pay cut if this vote doesn't go through. So the pay cuts and the layoffs could turn out to be worse than the plan that you're voting on.
I think the company is just as afraid of the effects of the pay cut as we are. I mean, I dread the idea of losing a quarter of my weekly income, but they're very worried about trying to manage a news staff that is going through the kind of deep cuts and the bitterness that's going to follow that would happen if we had a 23% pay cut. But I would argue that both sides, labor and management, have a good reason to find a compromise and to work out a package that is just a little bit less painful to us who've already been through 4 years at a single dollar's pay increase.
Then how do you make that decision? Kind of by taking a stand that this package is not fair. You could hurt yourself financially.
Yes, but I'm hurting myself financially no matter what I do, Tess. The package that I voted on today, if it is approved, it will cost me $19,000 in pay cuts and lost benefits over the next year. So that's a lot that they're asking from us. So yes, it's a risk, but I think there's a really important point that gets lost as people fight, you know, these labor management battles. We're actually not that far apart. There's a large number of the employees who just say, if you can find a way to make the pay cut not quite so deep, we'd all vote yes.
And finally, I have to ask you, I wonder, what's it like to become the story instead of reporting it?
I have a great deal more respect now for public relations officials than I did two or three months ago. It's not a position I really want to be in. I'd like to get back to the business of writing down notes and writing the tape recorder myself instead of answering these questions. But it's a really important story. It's about not just the Boston Globe, but it's about how are we in America going to get our news and information, and it's changing very rapidly. And right now, a major American paper is on the brink, and it's an important story, and I'm happy to play the role of source instead of reporter, even if it makes me uncomfortable.
Scott Allen is a reporter for the Boston Globe. Scott, thanks for being a source for us.
Oh, my pleasure.
The Obama administration is working on its soon-to-be-released blueprint for regulating the financial industry. One buzzword you will no doubt find in that blueprint? Derivatives. Traders bought and sold hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of them over the last decade. But no one bothered to see if the traders who guaranteed those contracts could actually pay up. And we all know how that turned out. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington on what comes next.
Derivatives contracts let companies avoid price fluctuations on commodities that might spike in the future, say the price of wheat for a cereal company. Developed nearly 30 years ago, derivatives took off in the 1990s, says University of Maryland Law School professor Michael Greenberger.
It's a contract that locks in a price in the future for, in the best purposes, for commercial ventures. In the worst purposes, it's much like going to a horse race and betting on a horse.
For example, insurance company AIG used a type of derivative called a credit default swap to insure hundreds of billions of dollars of securities backed by mortgages. When borrowers began defaulting on those mortgages, the securities collapsed and AIG was caught with more bad bets than it could cover. To prevent a wave of losses for investors that bought AIG's guarantees, including banks and pension funds, taxpayers had to come to the rescue with $170 billion. Bill Singer is a former regulatory attorney.
To some degree, the seeds of this problem was in a failure by our regulators to recognize the potential destruction that these new products that were being developed in the 90s would cause on this side of the new century.
So now regulatory reformers want to bring derivatives out of the shadows and make sure issuers have the resources to cover their contracts. One way to do that is to move derivatives from private trades to a formal trading exchange. That way everyone can see how many contracts get traded and at what price. Plus traders would be required to post collateral to back up their bets. A few weeks ago, a group of top experts and financial executives endorsed tougher regulations. The director of that group, called the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation, is Hal Scott. He says when it comes to a formal exchange,
the administration currently is saying we encourage it. We think we should go further than encourage, we should require.
But at the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, representing the financial industry, Corey Strupp says an exchange would make derivatives inflexible.
One of the huge benefits of derivatives products is that they can be customized to meet the needs of companies that use them to manage risk.
On a regulated exchange, he says, derivatives contracts would have fixed sizes and last for set periods of time. That means companies looking to hedge their risk might have to lock in a price for longer than they want or pay to cover more risk than they need with a standard contract. And big banks say that requiring more collateral to cover derivatives would be a drain on their capital. But Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, the sponsor of a bill to regulate derivatives, says that's necessary to avoid future failures like AIG.
I want to state emphatically, I'm not opposed to the financial sector making profits. We have to balance this desire for making profits with the countervailing balance of the public interest here.
In other words, providing real insurance for derivatives contracts is likely to cost more. And Maryland University professor Michael Greenberger says it's time Congress stood up to the industry.
My answer to that is fine. If you need these risk-shifting instruments, great, but let's do it in a regulated environment where the federal government knows what's going on and isn't surprised by mines going off in a battlefield.
Explosions that could end up leaving taxpayers with an even bigger tab. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Coming up, a new vision of entrepreneurship.
We have this made in Hollywood or maybe made in Silicon Valley view of entrepreneurs, which says that they're, you know, 22-year-old recent Stanford graduates in a garage somewhere in Palo Alto.
Yeah, not all of them. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow was flat today, inching up just 1 point to finish at 8764. The Nasdaq dropped 7 points, 0.3%, close at 1842. And the S&P was also flat, losing just 0.1% to end the day at 939. Food maker General Mills rose 4% today after beating earnings estimates. But McDonald's said its U.S. sales have risen, but it still missed analyst projections. Stock in the Golden Arches fell 2%. Quest fell 5.75% today. The telecom company had hoped to sell off its long-distance network, but dropped its plans today after failing to get any attractive offers. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale trade inventories for April. A Senate committee holds a hearing titled The Blue Economy, the Role of the Oceans in Our Nation's Economic Future. And it's the birth anniversary of composer Cole Porter. He was born on June 9, 1891. How de-lovely. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Today, the Obama administration announced 10 new projects designed to goose the $700 billion stimulus package. The White House says more than 600,000 jobs will be saved or created. But the package still has that Buy American clause that caused so much controversy. And commentator Mark Perry says because of that clause, when it comes to jobs, it may be Americans who lose.
Buy American provisions make sense politically because they create huge political payoffs for elected officials who protect jobs and domestic industries. But economically, Buy American rules, like all forms of trade protectionism, make no sense at all, since research shows that for every job protected and saved, about 2 jobs are lost. Why? Because Buy American provisions and tariffs protect inefficient domestic producers from more efficient foreign rivals. Take steel manufacturers. American firms that buy domestic steel are forced to charge consumers more. So retail sales decline, and thousands of jobs are then lost in countless industries that use steel as a raw material. And as American consumers and companies are forced to pay higher prices for products with domestic steel, they have less money to spend on other purchases. That's billions of dollars in sales lost to other industries, resulting in lower production and even fewer jobs. Protectionism also provokes retaliation. This weekend, representatives of Canadian cities, upset with the Buy American rules, voted for Buy Canadian policies that could block American companies from bidding on city contracts. The inevitable result will be a decline in trade with our largest trading partner and a loss of yet more American jobs. Consider what happened in 1930 when the U.S. raised tariffs on 20,000 foreign goods despite the protests of more than 1,000 economists. Our trading partners fought back, and U.S. exports and imports fell by 70%, causing huge job losses here and around the world. In fact, some would argue that it was protectionism that helped to make the Great Depression so great. Buy American provisions ultimately destroy more American jobs than they save. If we want the U.S. and world economies to recover from the recession as quickly as possible, we should end the Buy American rules.
Mark Perry is a professor of economics at University of Michigan in Flint. We want to hear your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org. Some 375 million voters turned out over the weekend for European parliamentary elections. The economy weighed heavily on the ballot. Unemployment and immigration topped the list of voter concerns. Christopher Wirth reports from London.
Center-right parties took about a third of the 736 available seats. Conservatives like Angela Merkel in Germany and French President Nicolas Sarkozy have resisted calls for massive stimulus spending, preferring to allow cushions like unemployment benefits and health care to soften the blow of the recession. Voter turnout was just 43%, the worst it's ever been. Andrew Hilton is with the Center for the Study of Financial Innovation.
I mean, the irony is that as turnout has been falling, the powers of the parliament have been going up.
The European Parliament now controls over two-thirds of European law, but frustrated voters have now elected some lawmakers who think the parliament shouldn't meddle in member states' affairs. Some of these lawmakers want their countries out of the EU altogether. As a further sign of disarray, Britain's Conservative Party will pull out of an influential Conservative bloc in the parliament. The Tories will lose representation on key committees that oversee financial regulation across Europe. Katinka Barish of the Center for European Reform says that worries the financial industry.
They think maybe they'll face all sorts of regulation from the less market-oriented governments on the continent that want to now impose regulations on vehicles such as hedge funds and private equity funds that are predominantly located in the United Kingdom.
That would be bad news for London as a financial center, and one more blow for British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. His Labour Party took third place in the British vote, its worst performance in decades. In London, this is Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
As we mull over an economic recovery in this country, we're all asking the same questions. When will that recovery start, and where will it come from? Paul Kodrosky is a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation. He argues that entrepreneurs are one ticket out of this economic mess. I asked him if that's really possible when we're in the middle of a credit crunch.
It's never easy to be an entrepreneur, and it's particularly hard whenever capital is scarce, but the reality is that the vast majority of those companies start with credit cards. They start with your own personal bank, which happens to be your credit cards. And so those things aren't really going away. Maybe the total amount of credit you have is a little less than you had before, but the disappearance or the relative absence of the more high-profile sources of credit really shouldn't affect anything.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what else might stand in the way of entrepreneurship these days. And you argue that there's a certain amount of prejudice about what makes an entrepreneur. Explain that for us.
Right. I mean, we have this made in Hollywood or maybe made in Silicon Valley view of entrepreneurs, which says that they're, you know, 22-year-old recent Stanford graduates in a garage somewhere in Palo Alto.
Right.
which is a great story, and we all love to tell it. But the reality is, outside of tech, most entrepreneurs are over the age of 35. It's a pretty even cross section between men and women. It's a much, much more broad, less youth centric focus. It just so happens that in technology, it is younger folks in Silicon Valley, and that. The wrong place to focus, because coming out of this recession, it's going to require entrepreneurial activity in far more areas than internet software.
Well, so then you have these non-20-somethings who are opening up these businesses. What is standing in their way? You do talk in the article about how healthcare is a really big issue.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, one of the myths in entrepreneurship is this idea that the primary obstacle is the availability of capital, when mm-hmm. most entrepreneurs are ego-driven people who believe that they can manage technology risk, they can manage capital risk. What they can't manage is health risk.
So this is an argument for universal healthcare, that will then allow people who are more worried about their health and really need the insurance to go out and start their own businesses.
Right. And as you know, if you look at surveys of entrepreneurs who are outside of the sort of the 25 to 35 demographic, their concern is, what happens if I get sick? And that prevents those people, many of those people, from going out and being entrepreneurial. They're risk takers, but they don't want to take risks in areas that they can't manage them, and health is one they can't manage. So adequate health care is actually an incredibly important obstacle that we need to face down if we want more entrepreneurs outside the 20-something demographic.
Well, so aside from healthcare, what are some of the other policy changes you think might be needed to help pave the way for these folks who want to start something new?
So, you know, healthcare aside, another example of an area where, you know, I think we could do a lot is in education, and not the obvious thing of saying, let's create more entrepreneurship programs. A better example of what we could do using education as a lever is to recognize that something like a third of all tech startups on the West Coast, to use that group again for a second, had immigrant founders. And we should make life easier for more such people who come to this country to do master's and PhD level education, to go out then and start a new company. So my suggestion is, and I say this somewhat glibly, but I think it's a legitimate point, of attaching green cards to postgraduate diplomas in this country.
Literally attaching the green card to the diploma.
1, 2, 3, go. I mean, it certainly beats the alternative, is where we give them this wonderful education, send them home and say, you know, good luck starting some new companies that we'll then worry about later on. Why don't we try and take advantage of it and build upon that success rather than making it more difficult for ourselves?
Paul Kudrowski's article, The Next Frontier, talking about entrepreneurship in a recession, is in the current issue of Washington Monthly. Thanks so much for your time.
Glad I could do it.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, I'll give you $5 if you can do the multiplication tables for me right now. $5 not enough? How about 10? I only ask because apparently bribery works when it comes to learning. The New York Post studied a privately funded pilot program in some New York public schools where kids are paid up to $500 for improvements in their test scores. The Post found that the scores improved by as much as 40 percentage points in some of those schools. Maybe we should try it in the workplace. Note to the boss. JJ, for $10, I'll write this story 40 percentage points better. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow inched up 1 point, basically flat. The NASDAQ fell 7 points, a third of a percent. And the S&P 500 was also flat. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, we talk bailouts and consequences with economist Anna Schwartz.
You might as well face up to the fact that it's a wasteful thing that we did, and we will have to pay for it.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.